had rushed across state lines, have been denied care. There are now two confirmed deaths in an abortion ban state that have been ruled preventable by an official committee, including 10 doctors. Both are Black women. I don't think it's an accident that we're seeing this pattern. I think there are more cases out there. ProPublica is certainly interested in hearing from people whose loved ones may have died, who have questions about how they died. And we are going to keep looking into them.
I wanted to give Monica Simpson the last word. Cecile Richards had spoken at the DNC. She actually is suffering from brain cancer right now. And in this op-ed piece she just wrote for The Times, her headline, Harris is good on abortion rights. Now she needs to take it to 11. Do you agree with this?
I do think that we are in a time where we have to not just look at where we are, we have to think about where we want to go, right? And what we have been saying for many, many years is that we know that a federal right to abortion is necessary, but access is even more imperative. And so when we think about the state of where we are in this country, knowing that we don't have the federal right, and we were already suffering from lack of access to abortion care, we have to think about this at the next level. How do we make sure that we're not only creating the opportunities for legislation that creates a federal right to be achieved, but that we are expanding access?
We have to leave it there. Monica Simpson, executive director of Sister Song, and Ziva Branstetter, editor at ProPublica. We'll link to both your pieces. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
I'm Molly, and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found at our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Rise and shine, because it's time to wake up the neighborhood here at KBOO. When you help support KBOO now between September 21st, your donation will be matched dollar for dollar up to $11,000. Just go to kboo.fm/give and become a member of grassroots community radio that you've grown to know and love.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this special membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News, Oregon schools have less than 2 weeks to spend down federal pandemic money or lose it forever.
Portland City Council candidates face allegations of campaign finance violations.
And the WNBA makes its return to Portland.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, September 18th, 2024. KBOO is currently in our fall membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Reed Johnson.
And I'm Althea Billings. There's less than 2 weeks left for Oregon public schools to spend down the money they got from the federal government for helping students recover the learning they lost during the pandemic. If they don't spend it down, they'll lose it. 13 days remain for Oregon school districts to spend $133 million of federal aid from the third round of funding they got, Oregon Live found. A spokesperson for the state education agency says the districts need to process payroll and invoices in order to get reimbursement from the state. Federal rules say districts must spend at least 20% of the funding they got on helping students recover from the pandemic. Later this month, the Department of Ed will release standardized testing data from last spring, giving a more updated picture of how Oregon students are doing. Districts had a lot of freedom when it came to how they spent this pandemic aid. National-level research indicates some strategies for improving kids' learning were better than others, like frequent small group tutoring, rigorous summer school, and extending the school year.
Multiple city council candidates may have violated election laws. Several candidates exchanged emails discussing swapping donations to meet qualification standards for the city's small donor elections program. The program was designed to give first-time candidates the chance to run a competitive campaign against deep-pocketed opponents. To qualify for matched taxpayer dollars from the city, candidates must receive 250 individual donations by August 27th. Explicitly reciprocal donations between candidates are ineligible for matched funds. According to campaign finance experts, these donations also violate Oregon statutes about exerting, quote, undue influence. Yet as candidates sought to meet the program's deadline, the city counted 970 mutual transactions. Most of these transactions appear to not violate campaign finance law and were marked by candidates as being eligible for matched funds.
A political action committee supporting Portland City Commissioner Renee Gonzalez's campaign for mayor recently received tens of thousands in contributions. Gonzalez's candidacy has received by far the most spending in this year's race. His reactionary pledge to be tough on crime and crack down on homelessness has won him support from downtown developers, property owners, investors, and some business owners. Among the major contributors are Schnitzer Properties, which donated $25,000 to this independent expenditure campaign. Gonzalez's campaign this year starkly contrasts his successful 2022 bid for city council. 2 years ago, Gonzalez took part in Portland's small donor elections program as he faced incumbent Joanne Hardesty. Back then, he spoke out against an independent expenditure campaign which raised over $100,000 for him. Yet his credibility was shaken by allegations he was circumventing these small donor election laws. The program's chief officer, Susan Mottet, accused the Gonzalez campaign of taking cheap downtown rent from Schnitzer Properties as an unreported campaign contribution. Gonzalez paid just $250 a month in rent for his Southwest 11th Avenue office. He avoided punishment when the city failed to provide evidence of the going rental rate of the space.
A new report looks into the recent shift in immigration enforcement, especially at the Immigrant Detention Center in Tacoma. The University of Washington's Center for Human Rights report, "The Border is Everywhere," finds immigration arrests have started to tick back up after falling at the start of the pandemic. However, the center's director, Angelina Godoy, says fewer of these arrests are transfers from jails or prisons in Washington and Oregon like they were in the past.
We see a lot of the more recent arrests happening on ICE check-ins or when folks who have arrived from the southern border are coming here and starting to comply with the process that ICE required them to do in terms of following up on their case. That's when they're brought into custody.
Godoy notes that both Washington and Oregon have passed sanctuary state legislation, which has reduced the number of these transfers. But other factors are making the average length of stay at the Northwest Detention Center in Tacoma longer than other detention centers across the country. The report finds that bond is granted in a fewer percentage of cases, and relief from deportation is denied on more occasions at the Northwest Detention Center than nationwide. Godoy says there's a perception that the Northwest is more friendly to immigrants.
They might imagine that the conditions here would be better than elsewhere. And in fact, what we're seeing in report after report is that's not the case.
Godoy says organizations like La Resistencia, the Northwest Immigrant Rights Project, and Washington Immigration Solidarity Network are fighting to improve conditions for people in detention in the region. However, she says immigration enforcement should be a big issue for everyone in the country.
A lot of inhumanity is occurring, and it's occurring on our watch. So this is something that all of us need to be concerned about and taking action to improve.
That was Angelina Godoy with the University of Washington's Center for Human Rights.
The WNBA is coming back to Portland. The new team is led by Lisa Bethal-Miraj and Alex Bethal, the owners of the Portland Thorns. They're also the children of Raj Bethal, a co-owner of the NBA's Sacramento Kings. Lisa Bethal-Miraj said of the move, quote, "Our goal is to grow this organization in partnership with the Portland community, and we look forward to supporting the best women's basketball players in the world when they take the floor at the Moda Center in 2026, end quote. U.S. Senator Ron Wyden helped this process along as well, saying, quote, when you look at our numbers, not just the thorns off the church attendance, which is incredible, what you've seen in Eugene, what you've seen in Oregon State, we knew that this was going to be one of the great moments in sports for Oregon, end quote. Key to the deal was Merritt Paulson's sale of the thorns to the Bethals this January, partially due to his help covering up sexual abuse and harassment committed by the team's former coach. The former Portland WNBA team, the Portland Fire, was owned by the Trailblazers owner Paul Allen. It existed for three seasons from 2000 to 2002.
This election season, it isn't just issues like the economy being debated. Access to reproductive care is in the spotlight, including IVF, in vitro fertilization treatments. On the heels of a high-profile vote in Congress this week, a Minnesota parent shares her story. Mike Moen has more.
A bill to bolster protections for IVF treatments failed in the U.S. Senate Tuesday. As the political debate plays out, a Minnesota mother hopes her experience opens more eyes to the challenges some people face in expanding their families. For the second time this year, Senate Republicans blocked efforts to put in place a nationwide right to in vitro fertilization, or IVF. The outcome is likely to get more attention on the campaign trail this fall. Mariah Gran, a mother from Bloomington, says she and her husband were both diagnosed with infertility. They are now proud parents of a daughter through IVF, but there were many hoops to jump through.
Infertility is a disease, and like any other disease, it is emotionally and physically exhausting. When your disease is not covered by insurance, there's a financial component added on top of it, which is equally exhausting.
She says the couple underwent many tests, took out a second mortgage, and relied on crowdfunding to pay for the IVF. Gran is now an advocate of efforts to guarantee health coverage for IVF treatments in Minnesota. In Congress, Senate Republicans say they support IVF, but accuse Democrats of a political stunt by bringing it to a vote. Democrats contend the outcome aligns with conservative ideals in curtailing reproductive freedoms. The issue received renewed focus when Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump expressed his support for IVF, even though some of his voter base objects because of religious beliefs. Gran says people have their right to their opinions about an issue, but those beliefs shouldn't come at the expense of access to reproductive care.
It's isolating. Our society has created a taboo around it for so long.
Although the U.S. Senate vote failed, Gran says it's encouraging to see policymakers debate this topic openly. Minnesota Governor and Democratic Vice Presidential nominee Tim Walz has frequently called for expanded access to IVF, citing his family's struggle with infertility. The Minnesota bill stalled earlier this year amid debate over costs. It's expected to see another push in 2025. This is Mike Moen for Minnesota News Connection.
J.D. Vance calls for toning down political rhetoric while calls for his resignation grow because of his own comments. And the Secret Service again faces intense criticism. With more on these stories, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
We can disagree with one another, we can debate one another, but we cannot tell the American people that one candidate is a fascist, and if he's elected, it is going to be the end of American democracy.
Republican vice presidential candidate J.D. Vance is calling for cooler rhetoric after a second assassination attempt on former President Donald Trump. This comes as both Trump and the Ohio senator continue to repeat false claims about Haitian immigrants eating pets in Springfield. Since telling CNN that he and Trump intentionally created the story that has sparked multiple bomb threats, some in his state are calling for him to resign from the Senate. House lawmakers are voicing deep frustration at the Secret Service after the Florida assassination attempt, even as they point to the agency's failings during the first attempt in Pennsylvania. Attorney General Merrick Garland says the Justice Department is investigating this new case.
The entire Justice Department, including in particular the FBI, the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of Florida, the National Security Division, are all coordinating closely with our local state law enforcement partners on the ground.
Secret Service leaders say Trump receives the same protection as all former presidents, but Alabama Republican Senator Tommy Tuberville says that's not enough.
You can't do it with just a basic group of Secret Service. It can't happen. You have to, and we have to give him more support, whether it's Rangers, whether it's Navy SEALs, whether it's more DHS.
Meanwhile, a bill explicitly granting a national right to access in vitro fertilization again failed to overcome a Republican Senate filibuster, although by a narrower margin. IVF has become a hot election issue, and Trump has even alienated some anti-abortion voters by saying it should be provided at no cost. But Democratic Washington State Senator Patty Murray says families who need it don't want false promises.
The last thing their heart can bear is false hope. So don't you dare breathe another word about helping them get IVF when you are not willing to put up the votes and make it happen.
Former government officials testified before Congress about the risk of stripping federal employees of civil service protections. A Trump executive order could have reclassified nonpartisan federal workers, making them subject to firing if they're deemed disloyal. President Joe Biden rescinded the order before it could take effect, but former Deputy Homeland Security Secretary Elaine Duke says plans in Project 2025 to bring a radically expanded version back are a bad idea.
The vast majority of civil servants are doing their job, and even Schedule F proponents agree with this. Policy personnel are using their knowledge, skills, abilities, and experience to deliver results.
The former president's campaign performance is clobbering Trump Media and Technology Group stock. The holding company for Truth Social reached record lows since being listed on the NASDAQ earlier this year, plunging 10% the day after the debate. Trump's majority stake is worth around $2 billion, and selling it off could bolster his campaign's war chest, but he's vowed not to sell his shares despite their withering worth. I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You are listening to a fall membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News. Our goal is to raise $30,000 by September 21st. We'd like to remind you, you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with Street Roots reporter Jeremiah Hayden about his latest article about the, quote, unconscionable conditions that homeless residents of Grants Pass are enduring. At 6, it's Earth Riot Radio. At 6:30, it's Free Culture Radio. Then at 7, Civic Cipher. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with an overnight low of 58 degrees. Tomorrow's weather, partly sunny with a high of 73. Today in history, in 1984, Joe Kittinger completes the first solo balloon crossing of the Atlantic. And our quote of the day is from British author Samuel Johnson, born this day in 1709. He said, quote, "A fly, sir, may sting a stately horse and make him wince, but one is but an insect, and the other is a horse still."
A Republican candidate for Senate in Montana is facing backlash for offensive comments. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Montana is a key battleground for control of the U.S. Senate this year. Tribal leaders say the Republican candidate needs to apologize for offensive comments that perpetuate racist stereotypes. Yellowstone Public Radio's Jackie Coffin has more.
Native Americans in Montana have reliably voted for Democrats for decades, helping John Tester win three terms in the U.S. Senate. Republican newcomer Tim Sheehy is recently polling slightly ahead of Tester, but is facing scrutiny from tribal leaders after comments he is said to have made at a couple of private fundraisers were leaked to the media. Here's one about a trip to the Crow Reservation for a cattle branding event.
Great way to bond with all the Indians to be out there while they're drunk at 8 a.m. and you're rolling together.
Sheehy is said to have made the comments last November. In August, the Sharkusta News, a publication of the Flathead Indian Reservation, posted the audio online. The source of the audio has not identified themselves. Sheehy's campaign has not disputed the authenticity of the recording. Tribal leaders recently held a press conference to discuss the comments.
We promote love, unity, respect. We're not drunks. We're a lot more things than what he said.
Bryce Kirk, who is Assiniboine Sioux, is chairman of the Rocky Mountain Tribal Leaders Council, which represents 12 tribal nations in three states.
My message to Tim Sheehy is to apologize, is to say I'm sorry. For once, let your pride aside and sit there and say, I'm sorry for the remarks that I made. I'm sorry for what I said.
So far, the Sheehy campaign has not responded publicly to tribal leaders. Soon after the audio was leaked, a campaign spokesperson told the Associated Press, quote, what folks are insinuating about him, that's just not who he is, end quote. Sylvan covers up a member of the Crow tribe, says Native people are willing to give Sheehy a chance.
He's probably a swell guy. You know, he's a veteran. I respect him for that.
But covers up says the leaked comments are not good for the candidate.
And they talk about it at different powwows now, and so it's making a mark.
Indigenous people make up about 7% of Montana's population, a significant voting bloc in a race that's expected to be decided by a very slim margin. I'm Jackie Coffin in Billings.
$100 million federal dollars are headed toward U.S. states to reduce flammable trees and underbrush, particularly in areas close to homes and communities. And in Wyoming, that chopped timber will be going to tribal members to heat their homes. The Mountain West News Bureau's Hannah Merzbach reports.
In Wyoming, Dennis O'Neill has been delivering bundles of firewood to over 80 Northern Arapaho seniors for years, since they often rely on wood stoves for heating.
We're a supplement to help them out through the winter months.
But now, thanks to the new funding, O'Neill and his team will have a more consistent source of wood. $5 million is dedicated towards thinning and prescribed burning around private properties in the Snowy Range in eastern Wyoming, which was home to one of the largest wildfires in the state's history back in 2020.
We'll be doing our part to remove some of the wood would possibly burn.
Similar partnerships that reduce wildfire risk and help tribes heat their homes are already going on in Arizona, New Mexico, Colorado, and Idaho. For National Native News, I'm Hannah Merzbach.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
A second set of wireless devices, this time Hezbollah walkie-talkies, exploded in Lebanon today, killing 14 and injuring over 450. Yesterday, thousands of Hezbollah pagers exploded simultaneous in Lebanon, killing 12, including a 10-year-old girl, and injuring over 2,800. Two sources have said that Israeli agents tampered with the pagers, putting 1 to 2 ounces of explosives and a remote trigger in them. Hezbollah purchased the pagers from a Taiwanese company after Hamas's October 6th attack on Israel, since the pagers would not give out the user's location, as cell phones do. Hezbollah pledged to retaliate against Israel over the attack, which reportedly injured Iran's ambassador to Lebanon, as well as Hezbollah fighters and medics, including some in Syria. Israel did not claim responsibility for either attack. A spokesperson for the U.S. State Department denied that the Biden administration was involved in the attack or aware of the operation in advance.
The U.S. Department of the Interior announced this month how it will distribute millions of dollars in federal funding for wildfire management in 2025. Some experts say communities need a larger share. Kathleen Shannon has more in Wyoming.
This month, the federal government announced funding for next year's wildfire management, totaling $236 million. Experts hope threatened communities in Wyoming receive some of those funds. Money from the bipartisan infrastructure law will be used to help reduce wildfire risk, improve firefighter training, rehabilitate burned areas, and advance research, according to the Interior Department. Those focus areas are partly based on a report last year from the Wildland Fire Mitigation and Management Commission, with 148 recommendations on how the U.S. can approach fires more effectively. Commission member Kimiko Barrett says the recommendations build off one another, but the federal government has focused on some more than others.
So it's not surprising that some of the policy is cherry-picking those recommendations that seem to be easiest or more reasonable given the time constraints of the current administration.
The U.S. House of Representatives will consider a bipartisan bill this month called the Fix Our Forests Act. It could adjust permitting under the National Environmental Protection Act to make wildfire prevention projects happen faster, among other changes. Most wildfire management is supported at the federal level through agencies that manage public lands, as well as state foresters and natural resource managers. But Barrett notes communities are often the first line of defense when a fire ignites.
communities and counties need to be additionally empowered and provided the funding, the resources, the technical assistance to be able to have more ownership over becoming more resilient.
Barrett says the protection of the built environment is especially important to communities, including home and neighborhood infrastructure. I'm Kathleen Shannon reporting for Wyoming News Service.
A program that brings self-monitoring blood pressure sites to the Northwest has opened its first in Portland. The program will provide loaner blood pressure cuffs. Eric Tegedoff reports.
Self-measure blood pressure sites are coming to the Northwest, starting with a community organization in Portland. The American Heart Association and Providence Health Plan have launched a program to bring self-monitoring blood pressure equipment to 20 clinics and community organizations in Oregon and Washington. The first was introduced at Portland Opportunities and Industrialization Center, a training center that serves more than 3,000 students aged 17 to 65. Michael Hale is health navigator for the center and says some people get white coat syndrome when they visit the doctor, causing inaccurate blood pressure numbers.
The beauty of this program is to be able to have our staff use the blood pressure monitors at home or in their office when they're regulated, before they drink their coffee, and then they'll be able to log it throughout the week and then use that information, take it to the doctor.
Hale says people can then discuss with their doctors whether it's time for blood pressure medication or lifestyle changes, depending on the readings. The program will loan out blood pressure monitoring equipment to students, families, and staff at the POIC. Blood pressure is an important indicator of health. Left untreated, high blood pressure can lead to heart attack, stroke, and other health issues. American Heart Association Oregon and Southwest Washington Executive Director Meredith Collett says the program is designed to bring monitoring to people who may not have access.
Our hope with our collaboration with Providence Health Plan is to remove those barriers to healthcare access by setting up these self-measured blood pressure cuffs with POIC for at-risk communities so they can really track and understand their numbers.
The initiative to bring self-measured blood pressure equipment to clinics and organizations in the Northwest is expected to expand to 20 over the next 3 years. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Public libraries are increasingly lending more than just books to help change consumer habits. A temporary clothing library in Dover, New Hampshire was a huge success and helped educate borrowers on the growing problem of fast fashion and textile waste. Catherine Carley has more on the story.
Libraries are increasingly lending more than just books in an effort to change consumer behavior. A temporary clothing library in Dover, New Hampshire borrowed more than 100 special occasion wear pieces over the course of 6 weeks, and all of them came back clean and in good condition. Creator Stella Martinez McShera says libraries offer the perfect model for clothing swaps and can help educate consumers about the impacts of textile waste.
One of the things people marveled at over and over again was like, I cannot believe this didn't already exist. It's a no-brainer.
She says libraries also tend to be centrally located in communities and could offer a more sustainable option for people who need items for a job interview or special holiday event. Studies show that by extending the life of clothes by just 9 months can reduce carbon, water, and waste footprints by up to 30%. The demand for trendy, inexpensive clothing has led to a worldwide buildup of textile waste, much of it synthetic material that releases microplastics into the environment. Many returned clothing items also end up in landfills, as it's more cost-effective for companies to dispose of clothing rather than reintegrate it back into the marketplace. Dover Public Library Director Denise LaFrance says she'd love to find the clothing library a permanent space in her collection and calls it a logical next step in library services.
You know, we see a lot of people in the community that come to use us because money's tight, and so this is a great place to leverage materials that you might not get to use.
She says the clothing library kicked off with a fashion show featuring librarians in the latest looks, followed by workshops on mending and styling. LaFrance says she even borrowed clothing herself, a pair of gray silk pants that would normally retail for $400. That's something she says she would never buy, but they were fabulous. This story was produced with original reporting by Claire Ellis Thompson from Grist. For New Hampshire News Connection, I'm Catherine Carley. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
It is Wednesday, and that means a visit from KBOO News poet Dan Raphael, who's trying to cast out his worries.
I worry that the second attempt to kill Trump will lead some MAGA person to even the score and go after Harris or Walls. I worry that Carmen Rubio's unpaid parking tickets and suspensions will pave the already likely way for Rene Gonzalez, whose own driving violations and suspensions the Oregonian didn't mention, to be the next mayor. I want to bring back that song, Walk Away, Rene, and have it everywhere. I worry there's some unseen trick in the new city council's election and structure that will give the mayor more power than advertised. I'm trying to keep my worries local, but I worry that too many people disapproving Harris's stand on Israel and Gaza will vote for neither major candidate and tip the electoral scales in a battleground state or two for the Orange Menace. If Donnie thought he won the debate, he won't accept an election loss. Okay, enough worry. I worry we won't get enough rain at the right time for there to be chanterelles. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You are listening to a fall membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, September 18th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Dan Raphael, Doug McVeigh, and Reed Johnson. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Ray Bodwell. Special thanks to Eric Tegadoff, Kathleen Shannon, Edwin J. Vieira, Catherine Carley, Antonia Gonzalez, and Mike Moen. The director of evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings.
And I'm Reed Johnson. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our great members. KBOO is currently in our fall membership drive, so now is a great time to join. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth. We'll be talking about the conditions that homeless Oregonians are facing in Grants Pass.